Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist. The Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee with our head coach, Chad Timmerman.
Hey, everybody.
Our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hey, hey.
And this is where you get answers to your cycling and triathlon related questions. You can submit them at trainerroad.com/podcast. Before we get into that, we should talk about a few things.
Yeah. First thing is
kick it off
on Facebook. There is a new Facebook group called Trainer Road. Beta, what is it called? Oh my God. Trainer Road Beta Users?
It's the Beta Group.
Yep. Trainer Road Beta Group. That's what it's called. It's linked to our actual page. Mm-hmm. And we're putting our newest stuff in there. We have some discussions about actually a new testing protocol, discussions in there. We have things releasing very, very, very soon. Mm-hmm. I'm watching a little countdown on my computer. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, go in there. But again, It's kind of fun to have a discussion about some of these new things and help guide Trainer Road. Yeah. But if you're not interested and you just want to get it at the end, don't go in there.
Yeah. Yeah. You're welcome to though. So check that out. Before we do that too, something I wanted to mention was on the blog this week, we talked we have a training plan guide that we released. It's titled How to Coach Yourself to Peak Fitness. And we tried to go across all of those different adjustments that you have to make or contingencies that you have to consider whenever you're laying out your plan and how you can use our plans that have a base phase, a build phase, and a specialty phase to get ready for your goal event. So if you've ever had questions like, how do I adjust my training plan for X? Or what training plan should I pick to get ready for this? If you go onto that blog post, you'll be able to see how to lay things out. And then it's pretty straightforward, relatively speaking. So it should be a big help for a lot of folks because we get that question quite a lot. So Nate, you raced this weekend, mountain bikes. Yeah.
It was kind of a spur of the moment thing because I was mm-hmm. still getting over and I still am getting over my sickness. And I think this is the first ever race that was like a C priority, meaning I trained through it. I think there's this thing where I thought about it. My ego is so big that doing a C race is ooh, that hurts. Self-deprecating is fine. When everyone else starts agreeing with you, you're like, ah. Anyways, my ego is so big that it's hard to like train the day before a race. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking back through all of my races I've ever done, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. I always at least take the day off before.
Yeah, yeah. Even though it's like a small race, you still want to smash it.
Yeah, you
so,
still.
Yeah, yeah, but that's the proper spirit for a true training race. So mm-hmm. that's how you do it. You basically hobble yourself. No, you don't.
To train
through. You absolutely don't. You do what you did. You do a workout just prior and then go and see what comes, what happens.
I know. I kind of wanted to. I still did great. I won my division, which is 30 to 39 sport.
First mountain bike race you've won, right? Or no?
Yeah. But, yeah. So.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I don't want to say big. I won the whole thing, but.
But you know, you won your division though. Yeah. That's big.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah, like I feel like we should stop and recognize
Win's
that.
Win's a win, man. Yeah.
Because let's rewind a year.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And you were like.
I'm much better at mountain biking now.
Well, yeah, you were terrified of a lot of things on trails and you weren't comfortable with that. And not only that, but you're also much fitter now too. So.
1 year
it's
ago.
Pretty cool.
I was one day out of being a broken collarbone.
There we go. Yeah, so I think that's pretty awesome.
There were only 7 people in my division and. The guy who's second place, Trainer Road User.
Nice.
He listened to the podcast and he said, Nate, and in the middle, he was beating me for like 2/3 of the race.
Oh, really?
And I asked him his name so I could turn off his account because this is not cool, guys. Not cool. But so anyways, I won that. And then immediately at the race, Craig Manning, great local mountain biker, real mm-hmm. fast, 50.
Great guy.
He goes, time to move up. Mandatory mm-hmm. upgrade. Mm-hmm. And I always make fun of my other friend, Casey in Reno. We have A, Bs, and Cs.
Yeah.
And he won every B race. And I'm like, dude, you need to move up to expert. Or the A's. Yeah. And in this race that I did, there's the export, there's a sport that I raced, then there's the novice.
Yeah, which so I'm is, in the, it's synonymous with Cat 3, 2, 1. You have novice is Cat 3, sport is Cat 2, expert's Cat 1.
So I put on Strava, time to move up.
Yeah.
And then my Strava feed just goes, what are you crazy? Don't move up. Don't do that. And then so I've been going back and forth. And the discussion I think we should have here is, when is it time to move up? Mm-hmm. And just Chad, I'm going to point this more at you. Mm-hmm. During this race, I definitely felt like I was racing because I was with Brandon. Like I had to attack Brandon. Mm-hmm. There was a section where I could pass that was big and I had to like put it all in. So I definitely felt like I was using tactics. I wasn't just hanging on.
Yeah.
And if I look at the overall, there's a bunch of high school kids who didn't start in my lap that beat me. Overall, I only got 18th out of.
Those high school kids are so fast.
Yeah. Out of 111.
Still respectable.
Yeah. But that makes me, I'm not like I beat the whole field by 5 minutes. Right.
Right.
In that case, I think I would move up.
But a single good race performance or a single victory doesn't mean it's time to move up necessarily.
Agreed.
I mean, absolutely not. And I think it's a bit of a tease too. You get a little taste of what it feels like to win and you start to make those associations. You start to build some confidence in yourself. You start to further motivate your training. And then you basically yank that rug out from under your feet, dive into a higher category where you're just going to get beat up on for however long it takes you to get that first win. And then upgrade from there again? No.
I have a theory on this.
I have two different things. Yeah. My motivations to move up. And two, one guy beat me at the line by 1 second. Oh. I had a bad turn coming
that hurts,
in.
Hurts, man.
There was a real steep section. And Jonathan, this is probably a good takeaway.
Okay.
I didn't pre-ride the course. I didn't have time, but I should have went back to the finish just to see what the finish was like. Because there was a very steep uphill that went into an immediate 90-degree sharp
short
turn.
Short little thing I heard, right?
Yeah, real short.
Short but steep.
Short but steep. Probably like, you know, it'd be hard to walk up, but it's so steep you just kind of use your momentum.
And you only encounter it one time on this entire race?
Yes, one time in the entire race.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what I did is I went up really fast to try to keep my momentum, and then there was an immediate turn. So I kind of went into the bushes, had to stop and turn,
You probably knew fully what was.
Well, he was ahead of me.
Oh,
but so little mess up though, probably you would have been able to maintain momentum and energy, exactly. And maybe get past him.
He went up kind of diagonal, so his momentum put him already like he had half his turn. He done.
Oh yeah,
and he knew. So he was very smart. I was very dumb.
Well, yeah, or he just knew and you didn't.
I mean, it was so close to the finish that if I just took 3 minutes, could have seen that. Like, hey, what's the finish like?
Yeah.
And it would have been okay.
That's a good bit of advice. If you think the finish might be close and you can't possibly judge that or predict that.
Yeah. Then it's always, even if you're like second to last, it can still be close to somebody else. It's always fun, right?
Yeah.
An overarching principle for that too, but regardless of recon, but just turns in general, is always look to take the sharpness out of a turn if you can.
Yeah.
And when I say that, what I mean is enter wide. And then when you enter wide, try to clip the apex of the turn. So if you were to draw the curve, the inside portion of it, and then let yourself drift wide coming out. If you don't know the turn, you just have to set up wide, right? Because if you go inside, then you set yourself up with limited options and a tight turn for sure. But if you set yourself up wide, you have options.
And it was so steep that I didn't even know that there was a turn. I was expecting just to go straight forward and sprint. And then I was like, oh. Anyways, so my idea... The reason wanting to move to expert is it's an extra lap. So it's a longer race. And we have Lost and Found, Carson City, Off-Road 50, and Leadville coming up.
Yeah.
So I said, there's three more of these races I could do. And that extra time would be nice. The other one is with where we start, the sport division, we're behind all these high schoolers. I've never seen so many high schoolers.
Like, you know how much they have at those races, right? In the NorCal League, they have nearly 2,000 kids at every race. It is insane.
It's insane. So in that field, there's all fitness levels, just like every category. Yeah. And it's hard to ride through all those people.
Yeah.
And especially for me, I only have my downhill skills are better, but I really gain on the power section of the uphill, but it's single trap climbing. So I could be stuck behind four people where my fitness is higher than them on the uphill.
Mm-hmm.
So having the idea of the experts go first, a clean lap is also very, very appealing.
You're making a lot of good arguments for upgrading. And the argument I made maybe doesn't really apply to you. You're not out there to get victories so much as gain race experience and prepare yourself for specific events. So in your case, it might make more sense to chase that upgrade.
And I'll get last place, just so you know.
So what?
Yeah, let me share my thoughts on this. So I think, first of all, and I don't think that we consciously do this. I think we subconsciously do this. When somebody we know wins, and I'm just saying like in general, when somebody wins, then we go and we talk to that person. There's a bit of jealousy and we don't realize it. So we
Jonathan,
say,
you could win the sport.
So we say,
eyes closed.
No. But like when a rider sees another rider they know win a lower category, they're like, well, that's because it's a lower category.
Oh, yeah.
If I was down there, I'd be winning too. It's time to move up. Like it's kind of motivated subconsciously by a bit of jealousy.
Yep.
I see that a lot.
Yep.
I think that you should move up. So my stance is you should not move up, Nate. And the reason for that is because I think that you are in a situation where confidence is something that is extremely important to your success in mountain biking.
Back to the ego.
Yes. And I think it's really important, especially with...
I think it's actually lack of fear rather than confidence.
Yep. Yeah. And hopefully they dovetail together. They end up, you know, having an inverse relationship there. But, you know, even with road racing, I see a lot of riders that just don't have confidence either in their abilities or their tactics, their ability to read a race. Mm-hmm. And when you can win inside a group, I know that group will change when you step up and you'll have to relearn things, but you start to learn principles that can apply outside of that. And for you, Nate, I feel like that would be really important. And to get some wins under your belt on a mountain bike and to be racing at the pointy end of a race is good. Mm-hmm. And then with time, then you'll end up getting all that knowledge that you need later on. That you'll get from racing expert, but give yourself some time to learn the lessons that you need to learn now. Because like you said, it might be a while till you're winning at the top of expert, right?
Oh, so, forever.
Yeah. So give yourself some time here and learn that. That would be my two cents. Like in the motocross world, it was always, you could never move up. You had to get bumped, right? So you had to get enough points. And then if you got enough points, then you would be bumped up. And plenty of people always complained because one person would win for a whole year and they just win everything outright.
Yeah, I don't argue that. I just think you need the greater challenge of the longer races, considering what you've got coming up this year. I think that makes a strong argument for rushing your upgrade.
That is a good point. Yeah. You know, if anything, what you could do, and I know this sounds silly, but... and really tricky since probably you're going to have some podium pie to deal with after your races if you're winning. But even if like you do your race and then get out, and if you do stay down, you can still do more riding.
Yeah.
Like thereafter, you could go out and do another couple laps, something like that. Like do the same duration. It won't be quite the same, but
yeah,
because that is a good point, especially with 100-mile mountain bike races.
Just what his priorities are. I think it aligns better.
The other thing about the mountain bike racing is, just looking at this, I was six of like non-high schoolers. I was sixth place. But then in my start, I think there was only, I think I won my start I guess one other person was in my start. But it's just hard in a mountain bike race to know where I'm at. I even asked Brandon, the trainer user, I'm like, are we in sixth place or first place? Like,
yeah. And that's why a lot of race organizers put a number on your calf, either your age, or they'll put like 2, 3, 4. 4 would be for 40-year-old range. 3 would be for 30-year-old range, for example. And a lot of race organizers do that because it is chaotic with a mountain bike race. And then on top of that too, it makes it very easy to suss out when you can pass, because if somebody's from a different category and you see that on their calf when you're riding, okay, cool. You can say different category behind you whenever you have a chance, and then you can move by them in a safe time. But if you see that person is the same category as you, you shouldn't be asking for that, right? You should be racing each other. So be safe.
Can you is it cool, Jonathan, to go expert one day and sport the next?
No.
It's called sandbagging.
Well,
I mean, if you have the capability to raise a higher category and you downgrade yourself,
if I get last place in expert.
Pretty cheap move.
Yeah. So what I'm thinking is on a week where I want more, like I come in and I'm fresher.
Mm-hmm. You can't bounce back and forth.
I can't bounce back and forth.
No, not okay.
I don't think you can do
it. But what's the difference in me staying in sport? It's the same person than me doing one expert. Now I can never go back to sport.
You got to commit.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, granted, what you can do is, let's say you go to expert and you say, whoa, way too much. Then you can downgrade to sport and you can stay in sport.
But don't go back and
forth. But don't be going back and forth.
No bouncing. Yeah. Sure. If you upgrade too soon and you have the luxury of downgrading.
Yeah.
This one is everyone knows it's self-selected. There's no actual
There's no
license.
Like USAC requirements where you have to actually petition for a downgrade or an upgrade.
I think at this race, I could race the pro field if I wanted to. I just say I'm a pro.
I think you're probably just likely to get some dude all very up in arms at you off of that. So
if I race pro or if I race
expert? No, I mean if you bounce back and forth. So
okay, yeah. I don't know what I'll do.
Yeah,
you guys gave me a lot to think about. Sure, thank you.
Yeah, sure thing. Hopefully that helps some other folks that are maybe facing the same dilemma. So
but I think the takeaway is, just because you win your category, you don't have to upgrade. And I think if I didn't have anything longer, I would definitely stay. If I wasn't planning on Lost and Found and Carson City and Leadville, I would definitely be doing the sport all year round, because I'm winning by, you know, 5 minutes.
Until they make you upgrade.
I ever got that, where I won by like 5 minutes or something. Yeah.
Final takeaway on this, the worst people to ask about upgrading or not are the people you're currently racing or will be racing. Don't ask them.
Why? Because they'll say upgrade?
Well, yeah, or they'll say don't upgrade, right? So it's just that they're
scared. Oh, yeah.
So, I'm selfishly motivated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you won't get a straight answer. Last week, we talked about going into the science of recovery stuff.
We've got another announcement.
Oh, we do? Go ahead.
Yeah. Mr. Chad Timmerman turned 46 yesterday.
Yeah. That happened.
Happy Chad's, birthday, Chad.
Chad's very Thank grateful you. For that.
Thanks.
That's pretty old, man. So let's, some people are older, need to, I'll segue this, need to recover more.
Careful.
Jonathan?
Yes. And we talked about this, the science of foam rolling.
Is that where you're going with that?
Yeah. Okay. I guess so.
Old people.
Foam rolling, regardless of age, we talked about getting into some specifics behind it because I think that a lot of people have probably tried foam rolling and they thought, my legs feel good. But just feeling good, or maybe my legs don't feel good after foam rolling, feeling good or perceiving those sort of things, that doesn't really get down to brass tacks as far as what's actually happening as a result of foam rolling. So
yeah, and I'm going to look into it. Kind of a more surface approach. I'm not looking to benefit cycling performance, and I'm not looking to push foam rolling either. I'm going to talk about why people foam roll,
cool.
which is basically to release fascial adhesions, myofascial adhesions. So
can we talk about fascia?
Yeah. Yeah, so if you don't know what fascia is, I mean, we have an encasement around most things in our bodies. In the case of the muscles, we have myofascial tissue, connective tissue. And it's just collagen-based like most other connective tissues in our body. And it's simply an encasement. And within this encasement, there's basically ripples, if you will. Mm-hmm. And when we stretch the muscle, those ripples straighten out. But if we've damaged them, overused them, a lot of things can actually cause knots or basically perpetual contractions mm-hmm. that we can't release. We have to go about it different ways. We can't just do static stretches and hope for the best. We have to get a little more aggressive with it. Foam rolling is one way to do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, you're just trying to realign that stuff or get that tuft of muscle or that cluster of muscle fibers to separate and to realign. Mm-hmm. And that's it. So, whether you can do that with foam rolls or not is up to you. I have a problem with foam rolling simply because a lot of people use foam rolls that are too spongy. They're lumpy. They don't really understand what they're after, and they just roll mindlessly and think, this should do something. It basically boils down to more of like a self-massage, mm-hmm. which doesn't have any particular end in mind. They just do it and don't really see any benefit from it. So I take a different approach. I use different tools, and I'm more concerned with reestablishing mobility. Whether or not that's a performance enhancement or not, it makes my body feel better. If I can turn the pedals with less pain in other parts of my body, that's gonna benefit me in a number of ways. So it's more of a holistic concern in my case, and I think should be in most people's cases, mm-hmm. than trying to become a faster cyclist by using foam rolling to recover after a ride.
Yeah, I think that it's something that I've noticed benefits just across the board. Like even whenever I have like a tight back or something's out, I tend to rely on those sort of things just on a small scale too to try to help with
that. Yeah, and so I have this here for those people who can see and for those who can. It's just a little, it's called a supernova. It's just a little blue ball from Rogue. They have Kelly Starrett. He's got his Mobility Wad website. Either way, these devices are not hard to come by. There's a ton to choose from. This one is my particular favorite. Mm-hmm. Been using it for a couple months now, and it is actually changing the way my body feels in a general sense. Mm-hmm. And sure, that does help me be more comfortable on the bike for longer durations. But in any case, this has shown me how deeply aggressive you can get with this sort of thing and how important it is to actually be aggressive. Again, the mindlessly rolling back on the foam roll, not going to accomplish a heck of a lot. Mm-hmm. You find those tough spots, work through them, really mash them, or smashing is the term, and it's a bit of a game changer.
Yeah, there you go.
So you foam roll?
I do, regularly. I use a lacrosse ball to get into those specific spots that I need to really work on that are tough mm-hmm. to get to with something that's broad.
And that's why this kind of is a medium between a foam roll and something as small as a lacrosse ball. And mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be something as fancy or as specific as this. It can be literally a softball or, I don't know what would be bigger, but mm-hmm. softball, a couple of lacrosse balls taped together mm-hmm. can make one of those little dual crossball tools that you can roll your spine with, roll your feet with, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've used it for some time, and frequent listeners to the podcast know that I've dealt with overuse injuries and plenty of stuff, and it's definitely anecdotally in my case, it's been helpful in doing that. So,
well, I started doing it too.
Yeah, because you used to not do it at all.
Yep.
And then, what made you start, and have you noticed a difference?
I remember what made me start.
Pulled your back.
No, it was way before that.
Before that.
I use just the Amazon, like, I have two of them, a Trigger Point one, which is really expensive, and I have an Amazon one that's like $7.
It's great. That's awesome.
That's the point I was trying to make just there. Yeah.
And the thing that I like about them, instead of just saying it's great, it's really firm, But it's not like painful or anything. It's not like you're rolling on plastic. I've seen people using a PVC pipe. That could be pretty painful. But it's really firm. And if you buy some really cheap ones, they're squishy. And that's not, like you said, Chad, it's not as effective.
The reason I started actually is because you, Jonathan, you told me that the trigger point one wasn't hard enough and that you needed something more firm to get to actually feel that you get to those knot points. And then I tried to go on the trigger point one and I could barely put any weight on it because my legs hurt so bad. And I was like, well.
And there is a case to be made. I mean, if the tissue is damaged, so like you've lifted really hard or did something extreme on the bike and you have those micro tears, I mean, there is a healing process that you can impede by doing something like this. So there's a proper time for it. But if it's simply, you know, sitting on it and finding those tight spots in your glutes, for instance, finding one of those spots, sitting on it till it releases, making yourself consciously let the muscle tension go until you can get deep down into the fibers and actually allow them to, again, realign to just basically relax, you know, let that contraction go.
That's a good point. When I start and then I get to this point, I notice I'm like, you are squeezing your quad.
Yeah, you're tense, right?
And then you relax it.
It helps that mind-body connection too.
So it's been part of my routine. And I don't know, I don't think I've found any science that says like that will make you a faster cyclist, there's one science that does work, placebo. I feel like, you know, sometimes you do stuff in a routine and you're like, if I rolled last night, I'm going to have a great workout today.
Yeah. See, there's nothing. And I combed the annals of PubMed to look for something that would tie to performance. And it doesn't in a general sense, nothing that says specifically you're going to be a faster cyclist or a faster runner, et cetera. But there is, I mean, if you consider anything that binds you up and keeps you from moving neuromuscularly properly, and you can let go of that, there is going to be some form of performance enhancement.
That's what I think in my brain, but I just would like someone to study that, right?
Right, it'd be great.
How I told you guys, and this is not science,
right?
Okay,
yeah.
So what I thought of it as, like, my legs were so tight and sore, and they had the myofascial like casing on it, like a sausage.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And then I want to like break that open and it just opens up and it feels better. I know that's not how it works.
It's definitely not how it works. But
that's, I know, sorry. I know, but just mind, in my brain is like, what I'm thinking is when I roll this, my muscles now have room to breathe and grow. Yeah. And that's not how it works.
No.
I know.
No, so it's good that you understand that. But and I do want to say there is science. When you look for anything relating to fascia and muscle fascia, in particular Schleip, S-C-H-L-E-I-P. That's kind of the name. He seems to be the one tied to all these studies. So there is science that says how it merits the investment of time and can benefit. But there is nothing that says you're going to be a faster bike rider.
Yeah.
I also have special socks that I like to wear on hard days. Like that's the same
whatever
kind of,
works for
but
it.
But it's really it's, though, it's like
the guys
mindset.
That put the left sock on before the right sock on. They have these little routines, anything else. And when you have that routine that helps put you into a mental state where it basically predetermines a certain amount of at least psychological success for you, then, or psychological performance, then that's a good thing to do.
And that is Jonathan has my point. It's like, these are the steps that if I check all of those, I come into the workout thinking, you're going to nail this, right? And it puts me in the right headspace. So even though there's not science backing up, placebo is definitely studied a ton and helps.
Yes.
Somehow I can be aware of placebo and it still works, but.
Totally. And that's something that so stepping back from all of this, I think that this is a good example for people to analyze the different rituals, different processes, everything else that you have. Look for science behind them. I think that's a good thing to do because in a lot of cases you might be misattributing that and then you'll get into a situation where, like for example, let's just assume that you think that foam rolling, otherwise your muscles become tight like a sausage, but you need to split it open and it needs to breathe, right? So let's just assume that that's the assumption.
That's not how it works.
But assuming that that's it, what if you get into a situation where you actually like develop an overuse injury and you think it's because my muscles haven't been split open to breathe and that's inaccurate, right?
Yeah.
So it's good to look into the science behind these things. And then it's good to recognize that it's not necessarily bad to be reliant upon them. That said, the rituals that you have, make sure that they are repeatable, make sure they are within your control, because the worst thing you want to do is, let's say that you have a peanut butter and honey sandwich every time before you race, and that honey comes from local honey. And if it's not local honey, then you are screwed. And then you travel to a race and you don't have your local honey, suddenly your day falls apart. So just make sure that it's something that's repeatable, controllable by you regardless of your surrounding circumstances. And if that's the case and you can have that routine, then that's great because that will, and there is science behind this as far as psychological triggers and patterns and habits that put you into a psychological state. Yeah. So
when a triathlon, there'd be a lot of people would be like, okay, I'm going to do every time it's right or 10 right arm circles, 10 reverse right arm circles. Yeah. This one, get in the water, unzip my suit, zip it back up, put like, you know, do the everything in the exact same manner.
Yes.
Count my strokes.
It's just like you said, that's a ritual that puts that person in that particular headspace.
And so that's what I think is like rolling is part of that. I think like that ritual. And to me, it just feels good out there.
And there's a case for, you know, what I just said, mindlessly rolling on a foam roller. Maybe you're after nothing less than disconnecting, you know, just following that ritual, rolling your muscles a little bit, breathing more fully, finding, you know, just letting the day go.
Yeah.
If that's the case, then, you know, go crazy.
If anything, that keeps you off your feet, being busy doing other things
and
puts you in a spot where you're recovering, right? Like, yeah, that's always a tricky thing with these recovery aids is that, I mean, I look at like a lot of people use whatever the recovery aid is, it makes you stay still, right? Or be off your feet and that's going to help you.
Sit on the couch recovery for an hour with your feet up.
Yeah. Hey, it's going to help, you know? Tilo says, hi, this may have been asked before, but I really like the taste of beer and I don't want to harm my recovery. He says, so I've chosen to drink alcohol free, and he says free in quotes, beer, with less than 0.5% alcohol content. Will that amount of alcohol still harm my training and my end goal of getting faster on the bike? Thank you for your great podcast and training plans.
Yeah, so Thilo?
And Tilo? I would assume, yeah.
If you've listened to the podcast, know I continue to fight the good fight. I'm trying to prove that there is some form of performance enhancement
trying to prove
that goes along with beer consumption.
This is a study we know something about.
Yeah, this is proper. But in the case of non-alcoholic beer, it's as it is with anything. I mean, the poison's in the dose, right? And this isn't a very big dose of this particular poison. So a small dose, small ramifications. I wouldn't give it too much thought. In the case of an actual beer post workout, it actually starts to matter, and it matters on a lot of levels. There aren't really any beneficial metabolic effects to alcohol. That's the sad truth of the matter. There is, however, one study that I keep coming back to, which is it's a 2001 study by McCarty that talks about how moderate, mind you, alcohol consumption stimulates AMPK. So, I mean, we talk about that a lot. I mean, this has downstream effects that, you know, spur mitochondrial biogenesis, improved endurance capacity, and it also improves insulin sensitivity in the muscles. So when our muscles are more responsive to insulin, that means more nutrients get in, more glucose gets in, gets packed away as glycogen, more protein or amino acids get in and can do muscle repair, build new fiber. Okay. This is the strongest argument I can make. And then I did a little bit of math in the case of a beer that's 0.05% alcohol. So let's assume you're at the high end of what they say they're less than. 12 ounces, that's 0.6 ounces of alcohol in that can of beer, which is 17 grams of alcohol. Per gram of alcohol, it's 7 calories. So before you even add in the hops, the malts, the yeast, everything else that's in the beer, you're already pushing 120 calories for your non-alcoholic beverage. Yeah. That gives you nothing. All of which furthers the point that alcohol is the most empty of empty calories. It just is what it is. So, you know, if that's...
People were like Disney slow clapping for you right there. They were so happy. And then
as much as I'd like to say.
You dropped them off.
I think that math is a little bit
I was hoping
off.
Someone it's would a, challenge that math.
It is off, but just the idea is it's still calories.
Yes.
And the other thing to think about this-
Not necessarily beneficial ones either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Because calories aren't necessarily bad. You know, you want to have calories. No, so.
Chad brings up a bigger point in the scientific world where there's usually a study that says something, and as soon as it agrees with you, like
I've been hanging on to this one for the better part of 15 years.
Right? Yeah. Then you go, oh, there we go. It's settled.
Study.
And even though there could be, people do this with climate change, right? There's like,
Oh yeah.
I think it was like 4,000 or something studies that agreed with it and like four that didn't or seven that didn't.
Right.
And people are like, the seven, look at these, right?
Yeah.
And so I want to believe Chad.
You know, Nate, but you mentioned something last time we were talking about this, and Chad, you've mentioned this plenty too. It goes back to rituals kind of, but what you're doing after that workout or after that race or after something else like that, if that's something that psychologically helps you relax and recap the race with your friends, anything else like that.
Let's drink, Chad.
True. There is a balance to be struck. But right. If you're looking for if you're looking to optimize your recovery, alcohol's not part of that picture.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So you could just like, you know, I don't drink alcohol. Yeah. I manage just fine with that.
We had our vigorous team building session a couple weeks ago, yeah. 3 weeks ago, I think.
Still recovering.
I still can't drink a beer. I tried and I was like, oh.
You're a rookie.
Too yeah. much. All right. Let's get into Chris's question. He says, are plyometrics a good use of extra training time? If so, what are some good workouts and at what point in the season should this work be done? Also, if beneficial, when in the week is best? Rest days, high intensity days, recovery days. So that last part is kind of, we've covered that in some respects.
Yeah, it could be lumped in with all strength training.
Okay, cool. Yep.
There are some caveats and I'll get to those.
Awesome. This is something that I've done. I've actually used somewhat regularly plyometrics. Mm-hmm. I haven't done a whole lot this year because I've been spending more time just traditional stuff
in
the gym.
It might actually make sense too.
But yeah, it's been good for me in certain ways. We'll get into it later though.
Yeah. So first off, you know, what are plyometrics? Plyometrics are not just reactive or explosive exercise. They actually involve the SSC or the stretch shortening cycle. So basically the elastic component of your musculature, which means there has to be some form of preloading before you actually do the explosive effort. And that's what makes them plyometric. Mm-hmm. That'd be the difference. And then as far as, you know, extra training time, sure. If this comes at the expense, and this is the argument we've made in a lot of other cases, if it comes at the expense of training that could be more beneficial to becoming a better endurance athlete, no. But if you have extra time, it's not the worst way to go. Certainly not for multi-sport athletes or runners. For instance, there's a fair amount of science that shows that it improves economy, rate of force development, and certain muscular and mechanical aspects that do benefit running. When it comes to cycling, those same things carry over, but you have to consider how you'll employ that. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're a steady state athlete, 40K time trialist, do you need reactive strength or explosive power at any point? No, I mean, there are in that case better ways to spend your time.
I'd think of maybe like a cyclocross athlete or a mountain biker in technical terrain.
The guys who have to generate. So rate of force development, maybe. You know, how quickly you can create a whole bunch of force is relevant in a lot of cycling disciplines, not so much in others. Mm-hmm. So if it's one that matters in the case of criterium racing, anything that involves jumping or sprinting or surging up a hill or jumping onto somebody's wheel or anything like that, I think this is applicable. It can also help correct muscular imbalances. So if you do some form of plyometric training and you find that one leg is particularly better at that activity, well, that's an issue that's worth correcting. I mean, anything that favors one side of the body can have, you know, effects on your pelvis, effects on your lower spine, and those effects carry. So in that case, this is yet another argument in favor of doing something along the lines of plyometrics. Mm-hmm. And then my common point that I always try to insert is that it makes for a stronger, more capable body. So outside of the realm of cycling, if this is something that benefits your performance in general, just your day-to-day, why not?
Yeah. It's something that I've used. So I specifically think of mountain biking on technical terrain. Riders that need to mantle up something or they need to maintain a lot of strength to be able to like pedal through when balance is very tricky, right? When you're in loose terrain or something like that, I noticed that this type of strength is really helpful. This type of training that builds that sort of strength can be really helpful.
And then in terms of when to do it, without covering like time, the stuff that it relates to strength training, this should come on the heels of some form of strength training, some form of coordination. You don't dive right into plyometrics. There should be a base of strength work that underlies this.
You'll be extremely sore if you just dive right in.
Yeah, and it's
by
just dangerous.
Yeah, you hurt yourself.
Wrong. Totally. Yeah. It's very easy to do
Jonathan,
that.
Jonathan, as you get old, like into your 46-year-olds. But no, but really, even
do
me.
People get that old?
I'm at 35, and just from like coming down from the pull-up bar, like landing, and I'm not warmed up, Jonathan, like my ankles hurt, my knees hurt. I'm like, whoa, you got to warm up.
So it applies to older people, or, you know, that's a concern with aging athletes. Mm-hmm. And then with junior athletes, I don't know too many coaches who recommend plyometrics. Again, it's pretty dangerous. Their bodies are still forming. There's a lot of reasons not to push plyometrics on junior racers. Mm-hmm. And if you're wondering like what a particular exercise is, just like a jumping split squat. Mm-hmm. So, you know, legs are staggered and you simply leap up in the air. And then the preload would come with, you know, a bit of a dip into the jump, bit of a dip into the jump. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These are best done at the beginning of a workout when you're freshest, because what you're trying to do is improve muscular recruitment. You can't do that if you basically, you know, waste your muscles and then try to expect a high level of recruitment. So do them when you're fresh, and then don't overdo them. A couple times a week at best, and try to limit the jumps to, you know, 100 tops. And this isn't something you start with. That's something you work up to.
Yeah. I'm no expert on strength training, but I'm going to talk about it anyways.
Go ahead.
No, for juniors, just the rule of thumb usually is body weight stuff. And then if you do, some juniors do plyometric stuff, but it's built over many years. So for instance, my kids are in gymnastics, and I watch kids from old into these high school stud dudes doing the Iron Cross up there. And you can watch their progression in different classes. And at first the kids are doing just running and jumping and stuff like that. And then as they get older, it's a progression, but they're not taking someone who's never done it at 16 and then saying, now start doing these extremely explosive movements.
That's probably the argument for why a lot of coaches don't recommend plyometrics.
Yeah, because you don't have the history. But just because you're, you know, you can be 12 and a gymnast and you've been doing it for 6 years.
And you're probably well suited.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I want to say.
Yeah. Something that I've found to be helpful, at least for me, with an imbalance that I have, and just I have developed, and a lot of cyclists do, more lateral development than medial development with their quadriceps. And then that usually leads to some.
Tell people what that is.
Lateral is outside of your leg, medial is inside of your leg. So your inner thighs would be weak, and your outer part of your thighs nice and big and buff and strong, right?
And that goes back to the whole just stronger body in a general sense, more capable. Less, more injury proof.
Yes. And that's the thing. Like, I see so many cyclists that I think that if they had to go to Home Depot and they had to go pick up like a 4 2x4s, they would be out of luck. They'd be in tough shape. So this is it's a good argument for rounding things out. Sorry, Nate, go ahead.
No, just one more anecdotal thing. We talked a lot about a limiter being upper body strength and mountain biking.
Yeah.
I did upper body work, the mountain bike race. Upper body did not hurt one bit.
Yeah, we actually have a question.
And I was in such better position. I even thought on the third lap, I was like, whoa, it was a 90-minute race. I was like, hey, this isn't so bad. Yeah. Hey, these things work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the
durability.
And I was also safer and faster.
Totally. Yeah. One thing I was, what I was getting at there was an exercise that I utilized. And by all means, once again, this is working up to it, everything else. But basically, like lateral, like tires. I'm sure you've seen tires where you're just like picking up your legs left and right type of a thing. Mm-hmm. But imagine spreading those tires out wide so that you had to kind of lunge from one, like side lunge from one to the next. And you did kind of like a diagonal movement sideways and forward. And that really helped develop and awaken the medial portion of my quadriceps.
And your hip musculature.
And my hips really well. So that was one thing that I've latched onto and I retain. And I do those, usually I do those weekly. I don't do a whole lot of them, but it does help.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're a pure cyclist, you set yourself up for failure in a lot of realms. I mean, we basically move in a single plane of motion. And when we do it with low impact, and it's very controlled.
Yeah. And even though you might think that that's okay because you'll stay in that plane of motion, usually problems start to manifest themselves usually with folks over time.
The other thing that Cody Kaiser said in our podcast, but by the way, Cody made World's Team too.
Congrats, Cody.
Yes.
Congrats. Awesome.
For Cody, is that they're talking about arms or shoulders rolled forward like a bike racer.
Totally.
And also software engineers, any desk job, you do that too. And I look at myself on this podcast and I'm like, Nate, sit up straight. What are you doing?
I know.
So that's another thing that like,
we need a taller table, don't we?
We need a taller table, but it's the just working on that. Because, you know, as a cyclist, if it's a day job, you're always slunched over like this and your neck is out. And then if you're a cyclist, that's the position you're in.
Yeah.
And then you just get that
Can
all
we
the time.
Tease the upcoming video? We just did. Yeah. So we're going to address this with another video to complement the strength training video, the five strength training moves. If I had to limit it to five, these are the five I'd choose. Did the same thing with stretching. And this is exactly what it addresses, is this forward kyphotic hunched position that we spend so much time in.
And Jonathan, where could people see that video?
You can go to youtube.com/trainerroad and you can see it.
Thank you, Jonathan.
One thing I wanted to call back to foam rolling and this sort of thing. One thing that I find really helpful with a foam roller is, after a workout, I'll roll out my legs and everything else. Then I lay on my back and I put that foam roller in line with my spine. Then it's not like I'm not using PVC or anything that's like really hard. And then I just kind of lay back and that foam roller comes up to right where the top of your shoulders, where your neck starts. And when you do that and you just lay back and let your body flop, it basically, it's like reverses all of that bad posture that you have on the bike. It feels fantastic. It's just a nice way to relax. And I feel like it puts me in a better position. So that's another way you can do that. So
I can raise the table
to
too.
Apply to the desk jockey.
You can also
lower my chair.
Chair.
There we go. Lower.
I know, but then we look so little.
I'm going to stay high. This is good. Yeah,
we'll make Jonathan look big the rest of the time.
Yeah, we'll just have good posture.
It kind of hurts my legs too, but it's okay.
The last thing I wanted to say with plyometrics too is that this is a downside of plyometrics that I feel that when we talk about strength training, if you're doing like weights properly with good form, with somebody perhaps watching that form and checking you, at the very least you have a mirror that you're diligently watching or using your phone to like film it or something. You can't really check for progress in terms of like alignment or control with plyometrics very effectively. Whereas
tools, they're expensive.
Yeah.
Force plates and whatnot.
Right. But with gym work, you can really do a good job of at least watching your legs, how they track, for example, through something like a deadlift or through a squat or something like that. So one thing that I've seen a lot of people do is they just say, yeah, I think it's helping. But if you don't see improvement in terms of like, if you're trying to correct a muscular imbalance, you don't see improvement in terms of knee tracking when you're pedaling or gym work, anything else like that, it can be a bit frustrating and you might just be wearing yourself down without accomplishing something that you need. So Max says, hi guys and greetings from Germany. Having recently discovered your amazing podcast, I've been binge listening to the previous episodes. I got my hands on a smart trainer over Christmas, and it being my first encounter with power measurement, I embarked on an FTP test. The placing seemed to work out well. The pacing, forgive me, yeah, seemed to work out well, as by the end, I nearly threw up.
Nailed it.
Yeah, that means a good hard effort. It says, I only got my road bike this autumn, meaning most of my fitness comes from the summer whizzing around town on my fixie. So getting a result of 228 watts left me pretty happy. Here's my question. I'm a pretty light rider at 54 kilograms. That's 119 pounds. And 174 centimeters. That's 5'8". And he's 16 years old, too. He says, and sadly, live in the extremely flat area of Berlin. He asks, is my low weight limiting my FTP? He says, I'm aware that it makes more sense, or forgive me, I'm going to go back. He says, if I were to do upper body training in order to increase my body weight, would I be able to achieve a higher FTP and gain an advantage on the flats? I'm aware that it makes more sense for me to start training first and wait until I plateau for this to be really relevant, but I was mainly just curious. Cheers to the great podcast, Max.
So Max, you'd be surprised how much you can do with relatively little muscle mass, especially when it comes to being an endurance athlete. Mm-hmm. So that may be something that you turn to at some point. I don't know that if you feel like you've maximized your FTP and you simply can't figure out ways to drive it higher, maybe a little more muscle mass is the way to go. Mm-hmm. I think at 16 years of age and your size, well, let's not get that far ahead. Let's also consider, what are you after? Mm-hmm. I mean, what sort of rider do you want to be? Because if you want to be a pure climber, you're set, man. I wouldn't hit the gym at all.
Yeah, man. You've got something that people are like doing very bad things to themselves for.
Yeah. Yeah. So in that case, you know, you're looking to maximize your FTP in other ways. If, however, you want to be a faster mountain biker, you want to have what Nate just talked about, greater durability over longer races. I mean, there are a lot of arguments that do steer me toward recommending you spend a little bit of time in the gym.
I'm going to give life advice to Max. Max, you're 16. One, you're still developing.
Yeah.
Don't worry about being crazy fast bike rider.
Yeah.
Get some muscles on you for whoever you're trying to attract. No, seriously, I was 16. No, I was super duper skinny. Yeah, like a twig, got made fun of all the time. Mm-hmm. And it took me until I was like 22 in college to start lifting weights.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a big turning point in just my personal confidence and, you know,
totally.
Other people found me attractive then more.
Yeah.
But so you're at 4.2 watts per kilo. That's fine. I mean,
it's actually quite good.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
right.
Good.
So lift some weights and if maybe it helps, but I think we'll just be better in life, right? Like, just do it.
That's what I say. I mean, if we're looking at it from strictly becoming a better cyclist and a higher FTP, that's one end of this argument. The other being, do you just want to be a better human?
Yeah. Well, I mean, just to have it just more enjoyable. Just wait. So you have plenty of time to be fast, like in the future, unless you're like gunning to be a pro right now. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be your career.
Yeah.
I just give yourself time.
Let's address some things though, really quick with this. Like, you live in a really flat area and you're looking to be strong in this type of an environment. Honestly, even a big rider, if he doesn't have really good muscular endurance and ability to sustain power at or around FTP, anything like that, even though you're smaller, you may be able to beat those folks just in, you know, instead of 10 minutes down the road, you'll really start to shine at 15, 20 minutes down the road, 30 minutes down the road, 40 minutes down the road when you're still consistent and they're starting to suffer. So I think that a lot of times we put so much emphasis on our watt kgs, but in the end, it's really what you can do with it. And especially if you live in a flat area, man, just be a stickler for being as consistent as possible with your sustained work. You know, follow a plan like our sustained build plan and then the 40K TT plan, you'd be an animal.
Yeah, just keep in mind that most of what we do as endurance athletes is metabolic. It's not based on strength. So you can, again, you can do a lot with not a lot of muscle mass.
Yeah.
So make sure that you have, in fact, plateaued due to the fact that, I mean, if there's just no other way to ratchet that fitness up.
He hasn't plateaued. He said he's gotten
probably
his
not.
4.2 watts per kilo by, quote, whizzing around town on my fixie. Screw you, Max.
Super good point. Yeah. Probably got a lot of room to grow still,
lift
Max.
Some weights, do some structured training, come back in a year, and you'll be at like 5 watts a kilo at 135 pounds and feel great. It'll be great.
Something I want to cover, though, and this is a question for you guys, and specifically, I guess, Chad, but I see a lot of people think, well, if I just increase my weight, but do it through strength, not through fat. There are a lot of misconceptions here, but if I just increase my weight, my body will have to be stronger to carry that, and I'll thusly be stronger on the bike, is what they assume.
Stronger, yes. Stronger on the bike, not necessarily. Yeah. Again, it's metabolic. It's about what the muscle can do, not how much of the muscle you're packing around.
Mm-hmm. I feel like, too, the gaining weight thing is only when you're on a very extreme.
Yeah.
Like if Chad was 150 pounds, be like, Chad, maybe put on a little more weight. Like, because you're 6'1", right? 6'2"?
Yeah. Shrinking.
But we'll call it 6'2". Yeah. You are getting older. sorry, Chad. But you know what I mean, though? It's not, it's usually not someone in the middle who's 5'8", 150 pounds. Like, I need to get to 170 to be strong. That's not, I've never seen someone improve their watt per kilo who's in the middle by gaining muscle mass.
Yeah.
I can say if I were coaching Max personally, I would probably steer him toward the gym. Just because I'd want to see a stronger body in general. Yeah. And then we make him a stronger cyclist in the process.
Awesome. Sebastian says, hey guys, or Sebastian, I'm sorry. I'm just going to say Sebastian. So then I sound less pretentious because I don't want to come off like I'm trying to sound like I have an accent or something. He says, hey guys, I love the podcast and anxiously await each weekly episode. I was wondering how much of FTP can be traced to genetics. I'm 68 kilograms and have an FTP of 302 watts. Tested using this 2x8 test. This number surprised me, but I have since verified it by attempting and succeeding to maintain roughly my FTP for the duration of a cross race. That's interesting. A cross race is usually pretty, it depends though, could be like a really consistent cross course.
Yeah.
But usually if that's average power, then that's really hard to do with a cross course. Normalized power, it's still pretty tough to do. But anyway, he says, talking to many friends and fellow racers, I seem to ride considerably, sometimes 50% less than they do in a year as far as hours spent on the bike. I understand that there is quantity versus quality of training, but how much of my fairly high FTP could be attributed to genetics rather than the work put in on the bike? Thanks.
Okay, so lots on this. First off, in answer to your question, how much can be traced to genetics? A lot. Mm-hmm. And we'll get to that later. First, I want to steer us off course because I know that, you know, now that we mapped the human genome, there's all this interest in pinpointing which genes lead to what, and can I see what, you know, what works for me dietarily? Can I see what sort of athlete I'd be better suited to being, et cetera? That it's still basically an emerging science, right? So don't lend too much credence to anything that you read. They have probably made the greatest strides in determining that they can tie certain gene variants to susceptibility to injury. But honestly, outside of that, I haven't seen a lot that says, you know, they can look at your genetic code and say, you will be good at this. You need to do this. That's still, I mean, they're in the process and there's so much exciting stuff emerging, but it's just that it's emerging. So don't give too much to it. In answer to your question, most of your genetic capabilities obviously comes from your parents and your environment. I see it, if you have to quantify it, a lot of people put it at about 50%. That's where half of it comes from. The other half comes from training and how you respond to training. And there's a big genetic component in that as well. If you think of epigenetics and gene expression and how we respond to different things, which genes we flip on by doing certain things, eating certain things, recovering certain ways, et cetera. To quantify it again, put it all together, 80% genetic, mostly genetic. Which is not to say that if you don't have the proper genes, and I'd look at Taylor Finney. I mean, Connie Carpenter, Davis Finney, he's got about the best gene pool to draw from in terms of endurance athletes. Doesn't mean he's going to win every race.
Nope.
And we see that. You know, there's still a lot of other components that mix into this.
Yeah.
So don't just look at your genetic potential. If you've got a great genetic potential, that's cool. But what if you don't have the work ethic to back it up? What if you can't make yourself operate at a high end, push yourself toward your genetic potential? Mm-hmm. Then it doesn't matter how good your genes are. And then on the flip side of that, genetic potential is not great, but your work ethic is. I've seen plenty of riders who have like substandards by world level ratings or statistics, substandard VO2 maxes, and they go out and they podium.
Yeah.
You know, they can still make it happen.
So I want to talk about Jonathan versus me.
Okay.
And there's two things.
You have a preconceived notion here.
No, no, I don't. With. I'm going to say something different. Okay. I'm going to say one preconceived notion. Hear me out before we jump in.
Yeah. Because I've heard that before.
Jonathan, without much training or any training, he'll take time off and he'll be at 4 watts per kilo. Mm-hmm. I've never trained so much in my life being consistent. I'm at 4 watts per kilo too.
There you go.
No, but the thing that people don't see is that Jonathan has had many, many, many years of endurance performance, building that base,
and that's all the, through and influencing your genetic side of things.
Yeah.
And I just saw a study yesterday about, you know, it makes sense, but once you've been there, it's easier to get back to it. Mm-hmm. But they're proving it, right? And this is for weightlifters, but I think the same could go say for endurance athletes too, but. Yeah. You might look at somebody else who doesn't train as much as you, but maybe they all through elementary, high school, and college, they did a sport. Mm-hmm. And
I've always been playing soccer, hockey, racing, motocross.
Yeah.
And motocross is hugely demanding.
Exactly. And while you were doing that, I was playing video games.
Yeah, right? There you go, right?
So
yeah.
So even though if we just look at it, I look at your last 6 weeks of training, I go, oh, I train way more than him. How could he be that fit? Mm-hmm. But then if I look at our entire lives, Jonathan probably has 5, 6, 7 times more training than I do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's just something you have to think about. It's their entire history.
His genetic basis, you know, what he took from his parents and his genetic expression, how he's shaped those genes to act over time.
And for me too, my first mile, I think like I 10 some, like mm-hmm. I've never been a fit person. I think what was your first minute mile in elementary school?
I don't know the first one, but like I was usually like a sub 7 area.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. And I couldn't even run a mile.
Right.
So there's that part into it, but that doesn't mean you can't train yourself to be.
Yes.
Awesome. Just because I started lower.
I walked the whole bit of athleticism, bit of video games and didn't realize till relatively late in life, you know, 30 years of age that I'm actually a pretty good endurance athlete.
Yeah.
So just because I didn't manifest earlier in life doesn't mean it's not there to be exploited.
Yeah. There are certain people that they, so just thinking, I'm going to jump into motocross for a bit, but I'll explain these people to give some point of reference. But there is an athlete named Jeff Ward who was kind of small, not extremely lean. They called him the flying freckle. He did not look like the star quarterback, right? Like, but that guy's work ethic was absurd. He probably trained way too much, in fact, but he was the first one in that sport to bring in triathlons as like cross training, running, swimming, riding a bike, doing all that stuff as cross training back in the 80s. And he flipped that sport on its head because he was willing to work harder. It wasn't just natural for him. Mm-hmm. And that's something that he then, and even though this seems like it would be really basic, but he went on to dominate in IndyCar for a while. He won the Indy 500. Like he's done like a lot of incredible things in these different avenues that still require a huge amount of strength for an extended period of time. But I think that my point with this is you can have subpar genetics. Mm-hmm. For whatever you consider that to be, and you can still do so much with that in terms of expressing your ability or your ability to express whatever performance that you're going for. You know, it's pretty impressive to see. So,
yeah, I'm just reading like I talked about last time, but a book called Grit, and it's talent. Their talent times effort equals the result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
totally,
you just got to work harder. And it's so many. I'm speaking to a college class about entrepreneurship, and I was never the smartest kid in the classroom, and I never, you know, I didn't ace my SATs or anything. But I started a business because I really think I just outworked other people, mm-hmm. and other people launched a few months after we did with kind of a similar idea. Mm-hmm. But I think, well, of course, but you think. We executed better because, and I think it's all just effort.
I agree.
So that's the same with endurance. It's so much just, you can make up for, performance just by working harder than anybody else.
So you're talking about talent plus effort. I look at it in terms
times effort.
Okay. I look at it as capacity times, if you will, I guess, work ethic.
Yeah.
But then in our situations, then there's the ability to execute. Mm-hmm. So you can have the work ethic, you can have the big capacity, you can have, you know, everything in line, but then race day, you have to be able to put it all together. You have to be able to strategize and race well.
It's the mental component, right?
Yep.
That's what you're talking about during race day.
Yeah. You know, and that will be refined over time and years. And you'll find that is, you know, your solo as a bassoonist ends up preparing you somehow for being a cyclist, right? Like you can, if you take it seriously, like it helps you across the board. I would take 10 to 1 every day. I would take work ethic with a lack of talent versus an excessive amount of talent with a lack of work ethic.
Oh, so for sure.
And I think that we see
that. As a coach, that's what you want.
Totally.
Doesn't matter how much talent there is. If they're not willing to work, you're...
And we see
that. You got nothing to work with.
And it's frustrating a lot of the time when you see these athletes coming up, whatever the sport is, and you think, oh my goodness, they're going to redefine this sport, right? What records should be, everything else. And a lot of the time when they have that talent, but they don't have that work ethic, it doesn't hit. So the final thing to touch on with this, I think that I try to never tell myself that now I compete, I'm probably within the top few percent of cross-country mountain bike racers in our country. But I still tell myself that it's not coming down to just that person has better genetics than me. And I feel like that's a really bad move for you to do. I think that like Keegan Swenson, for example, like he's the number two cyclist or mountain biker in our country. And at that level, he's probably getting to a spot where that really starts to make a difference. But at my level, it's not. And if I ever do that, then what I'm doing is I'm trying to say that he's just better than me and it's out of my control. And then I discourage myself.
At that point, it's almost not even a question of the capacity and the work ethic anymore. Then it just boils down to that mental side of it. Who wants it more? Mm-hmm. You line up with 100 guys, 10 of those guys can win the race, are fully capable. Who's going to get after it that day? Who's going to do all the right things right? Who's going to really chase it like they want it?
It
goes to what we talked about last week about potential. And I guarantee you, besides like those upper level pros, mm-hmm. no one's really hitting their potential. Oh. So extra effort will get you to that level of potential.
Totally.
And it makes me frustrated too. Some people say, oh, I just have bad genetics, so I can't do X, Y, or Z in fitness. But then... And then they don't do anything.
Tired excuse.
Like I worked out for 1 week, the first week of January, and it was hard, and I didn't get super fast.
Yeah.
And now I'm done. I have bad genetics.
Yeah.
Or you know, there are certain things that would make you way more than other people, but still, people can overcome that with more hard work, right?
Yeah, and you're not stuck. You don't have to race well as a Cat 1. You can race well as a Cat 5 too. So,
totally.
I mean, if that's your ceiling, then strive to be the best Cat 5 racer you can be.
Right, exactly. And I agree. I think this is good. Hopefully we redefine some things for some folks.
How about effort? Oh, another thing too is, so on our Facebook group page, we're experimenting with a new testing protocol, and there's been a few people now who have...
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
...who have emailed, they write on it, and they go, okay, my new FTP is such and such. That can't be my FTP. You guys are so wrong.
And the reason that they're saying is because it's way too high.
It's higher. It's like 20 or 30 watts higher. And they come back, and like then the 2 or 3 days later, they're like, okay, so I did over-unders for 90 minutes. It was hard, but I got through it.
Yeah.
And I'm like...
If you can do that,
this is the right section for you.
They just open their eyes to the fact their potential is absolutely greater than they think it is.
Exactly. And I'm so happy that these people can experience this, that they got pushed a little bit harder and they could actually go farther than they thought they could.
Yes.
And this whole new world's opened up to them, right?
It's great. Yeah. You're going to get faster. The last question that we're going to have for the podcast here, and then if you're joining us on Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube Live, you can stay with us after this, and then we'll answer the questions that you've submitted throughout this podcast. But it's from Oslem. I hope that's how you say it. I apologize if not. It says, hey guys, I have a very interesting discussion question for you. Why are sub-8-hour Ironman finish times achieved by so many athletes lately? I'm super curious about your opinions as you guys would approach it on a more analytical level. Many suspect the developments on the bike to be the cause, but I would first look to see a comparison of the times in different legs. I think you guys would look at all the aspects and would make a better judgment about the reasons behind these faster times. I really like to listen to your podcast during my car rides and I'm kind of addicted to it. Thanks a million and enjoy your training. I did a deep dive of sorts on this. You gents can click that link that we have in here so you can see it, but I looked at the times from, I just looked at male finishing times in 2017, 2015, 2010, 2005, 2000, 1995, and 1993.
Well, you're looking at Kona.
And I picked one race.
And that's not a very good one to start to show because the conditions change so much.
No, but but we're averaging this out across the board. And the point is we look at conditions. Don't worry. I've thought of this stuff, Nate. Okay. You take a step back. So looking at all of these, the main thing that sticks out. So first of all, the assumption is the bike is where people are making the biggest improvements. And yes, when you look at swimming, there's really not much, there's not a massive improvement across the board when you average out the times from the top three athletes from those years. You're looking at fluctuations of a minute to 2 minutes plus or minus, depending on the conditions that you have. But with the bike, you actually do see that there is more of a drop in that one versus even the run, for example. The run, you see a drop, but it's not necessarily as great as the bike. So yeah, it seems like the bike is dropping down the times. But the interesting thing is if you look all the way back, so let's look at 2015. The 2017 was a crazy fast year. We can rule that year out. So that's a bit of an outlier. But then you look at 2015 and it was an average time of 4:28.11 for the top three guys. Jump all the way back to 1993 and it was 4:29.12. So not that far behind. That was also an exceptionally fast year in 1993. But the one thing that you do see across all of these in terms of what's getting the average times, if you look at them, they are dropping over the years. It's that the athletes are not just banking on one specific leg and just going for that one and then blowing their pacing routine out. You see more consistent lower times across all three of them rather than a person that's an incredible runner just running extremely well, but then disregarding the other ones or swimming or biking.
So they're getting fitter across the board.
Either getting fitter or they're being more intelligent with pacing. Maybe that's because of power meters, anything else. But the one common trend that you see with these decreasing times is that the fact that there's more consistency between all three bike legs in terms of timing. All three tri legs, sorry. Yeah.
My theory is that over the course of triathlon, the sport's grown up. Mm-hmm. And before with the pros, there were a lot of pros who they would try a main sport, they wouldn't make it, and triathlon was their backup. So going back to genetics at a pro level, and they didn't grow up and the money wasn't in triathlon. So when they were young, it wasn't like they were in triathlete the whole way. It was kind of the opposite. Like Lance was a good example. He was in triathlon. Then he got so good that he's like, I can make a lot more money in cycling. So I go to something else, even marathon running, same, you'd make more money. Mm-hmm. So as the sports gets bigger, more people come into it. Another example is like soccer or football in like South America or in Europe. Everybody's doing it. So there's such a huge talent pool that comes into it where triathlon still is kind of small. So I think there's still going to be major improvements with just the quality of the genetics that get put into it.
Yes.
If people were getting like NFL or NBA level contracts to do triathlon, like 10 million a year or something, the times would be so much faster because the best athletes in the world would be changing from one sport to another sport.
Yeah, like there's a Pop Warner football system that goes from little kids all the way up and then it's a very clear track. Mm-hmm. Like there's no stops in between the gaps, right? You go Pop Warner to going up into high school, then high school to collegiate NFL. Yeah. It's very clear and you don't have that at all in triathlon.
Yeah, exactly. There's the development. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times you'll see somebody's history and they may have been on the swimming track. Mm-hmm. And they even got to D1 swimmer in college. Mm-hmm. And then they missed the Olympic trials or they missed the Olympics. And now they switched to triathlon. Or the same with cycling. They didn't make a pro tour team, but then they switched to...
Totally.
The other part of it is, it used to be where you could be like a one-trick pony almost. Like you'd still be fit, but this goes to what your point is. Yep. But you were a runner specialist. Or Norman Stadler was a bike specialist.
And that's how I see this. I mean, I think people have gotten smarter across the board. They know how to train better, maximize their time, they know how to recover better. So they're simply training smarter. In addition to that, they're more complete athletes. They're not the run specialist who decides I'm going to try out triathlon or the fast rider or the fast swimmer. They are really good in all three disciplines. They certainly have one in which they're strongest, but they are really strong in all three of them.
Well, they have to. So that's what I think is like the culture's changed where you can't just rely on your strength is you have to build your weaknesses, on it to be competitive at the highest level.
And the interesting thing, so I think all of this ties together, right? As we have more people starting in triathlon earlier on and spending more time training in that, developing that sort of an athleticism that they need for that sport, we get a more well-rounded athlete. Mm-hmm. And then that, and on top of that too, I'm sure that the advancements in understanding, we now understand what the limits are better of the body and how to measure that. So these athletes know how to pace better.
Yeah, science is always improving.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that a lot of the assumption, at least from what I've read all over everything from Slow Twitch to on Facebook, everything else, a lot of people are just like, it's the bike, man. We have wind tunnels. We have aero frames now. Mm-hmm.
It helps.
And it does help. But you look at, especially on the bike, I mean, conditions can affect things so much. I mean, look, 429.12 back in 1993, that's pretty solid. So that was the average time that they had across the top three. The other point that I wanted to make with this was that there are also riders are being specific about the courses that they choose and the effort that they place on that day. So there are plenty of courses like Ironman Texas, for example. It's pretty darn flat. They'll have one in Florida. And riders are now that they want to drop that time down. They want to see their best, they want to PR with Ironman, and they're getting these courses that are almost like built for that.
That's what I was going to say is Challenge Roth.
Yes.
It's a famous one where people just go
crazy fast.
Crazy, crazy, crazy fast. Yep. But it's completely flat.
Yeah.
And you get in the draft packs and there's the drafting rule of
10 meters,
whatever the meters is, but 10 meters or something like that. But I don't know what it is.
Whatever it is,
it is enough to get a benefit.
Totally.
And when you have 25 people in that line, mm-hmm. it really helps.
Yeah.
And then you get people running like crazy 240, 239 marathons off of that.
Yes.
And you get a really fast.
If anything, it's interesting. I don't know the data behind this, but I'd be curious to see if the tech advancements have made a bigger difference for age groupers. But that would be really hard to like really suss out, But because I could see that, like where age groupers might be getting more benefit from a lot of these things, perhaps.
Well, you do with aero benefits on the bike. It seems so weird, but you save more time as a slower rider with aero benefits. And I know it seems crazy, but you do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think we can say conclusively that you save time on a super high-end TT bike than on a old road bike with round tubes.
Yeah, exactly.
Drops, right? Yeah. So that part is true. And I'm sure you could look at it in mm-hmm. age group times. The thing that really helps? Trainer road.
Yeah, exactly.
So weird.
I think people are just
dropping age group times.
Spending more time developing as triathletes. They're training smarter, they're racing smarter, and they have good equipment. It's a combination of all things.
So. And the pool too.
Totally.
It gets more popular, more people come into it, there's more money. The Brownlee brothers. Yep, that's a good example of, I think like they-
Almost like since They've been at it for a long time, right? Like,
and tier one genetics.
Yeah.
Like I think they could be professional runners or professional bike riders, and they could survive in that world at a top level. I don't know if they would win the Tour de France or win the Boston Marathon, but they could probably totally be at that elite high level.
I agree.
Lantern Rouge is still a very good thing to have. If you're Lantern Rouge, it's something like the Tour de France, you're still incredible. So well, that's it for this week, everybody. Thanks for submitting your questions. You can do so at trainerroad.com/podcast, and we will comb through those questions that you send to us, and we'll be ready to talk to you next week about them. That covers it for this week. But if you're with us on the live stream, stick with us. We'll answer some more of your questions. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.